Open the brackets, it's time for All Squared.
Welcome to this, the fifth edition of All Squared. This time we're speaking to Professor of Mathematics and recreational maths fan and expert David Singmaster about mathematical books. We've asked him what his favourite book is, and he's told us all about some amazing books that he has in his collection. Unfortunately, the interview took around 45 minutes, so we're going to split it across this podcast and the next podcast. What am I saying, unfortunately? It's amazing. Here we go.
So I'm very glad to welcome David Singmaster to the podcast. I met David at last year's big Math Jam conference in Crewe, where I gave a talk about my favourite maths book, and he told me all about all sorts of other maths books that he's collected and knows of. So hello, David.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm here, yes.
So is it fair to say that you've been a lifelong collector of maths books?
Well, I got into it really seriously in the late 70s when I came across the Rubik Cube, and I became one of the experts on the Rubik Cube and related things. And since then, I have been accumulating material for a annotated bibliography in the history of recreational mathematics, because I found it was very difficult to locate material. And there were a number of people who had written about it, but it wasn't really classified. In other words, if you had a particular topic like tangrams or one-pile games, etc., it was very difficult to try to trace the history of it because nobody had done it in that sort of way. So I've been accumulating material on this since then, and related books.
So how many books do you reckon you have at the moment?
Well, I have a catalog of recreational and popular mathematics books, which is nearly 10,000 items.
Wow.
That's a lot of books.
Yeah, do you have
a fair amount of books. Sitting here in my study library. We had to build a library extension a few years ago, but it's nearly full. And I also use the loft in another room for keeping books.
That is a sign that you take something seriously, that you've built an extension in order to fit everything in.
Well, my friend Jerry Slocum had to build an extra house in his back garden, a four-room house, to keep his puzzles.
Which are now in a university somewhere, aren't they?
They're in Indiana. He spent several years examining rare book rooms and collections, and he found Indiana was the most congenial.
Excellent. They've got quite a good website. We'll put a link in the post going with this podcast the catalog online. It's really fascinating.
Well, it's quite something. I didn't get to go when it opened, but I've been to visit him, etc. I'm more interested in books, but I do have a room full of puzzles, which is also true, and a wall full of Rubik cubes.
Excellent. Do you have a favorite maths book out of all of your thousands that you own?
Well, I'd like to sort of chat about a book that I don't actually have, because it only exists in the manuscript in Bologna. But there was a microfilm of it, and I had been sent a reference to the book, and I decided I wanted the manuscript, and I decided I wanted to look at it more closely and discovered that there are microfilms of it available. And I went to the Warburg Institute, and I photocopied a lot of pages, and one page in particular I noticed in the manuscript had in the corner a marginal annotation, which was a little string and board puzzle, a little topological puzzle. And this, when I later looked at it closely, I realized this is the earliest known example we know of such puzzles. But I hadn't photocopied all the text, and I had that text for that puzzle, but then it went on for another 10 pages or so, describing other topological puzzles, and I hadn't photocopied those. So I mentioned this to a friend in Bologna, who is interested in old mathematics, and about a month later I got a CD in the post. He had photographed the entire manuscript, all 600 pages of it, and had enhanced the photos, so right now it's much better than the microfilm. And, oh, right, I had tried to get more out of the Warburg Institute. They've mislaid the microfilm. I was stuck in the middle of a problem. And my friend in Bologna is a little bit better at medieval Latin than I am, so he was able to read a whole bunch of things and recognize that, amongst other things in here, is the earliest example of what we call the Chinese rings puzzle. This is supposed to be from China, but nobody has ever actually produced any definite evidence of its existence in China. And this is the earliest known example we knew of was in Cardan, about 1550, and this manuscript dates from about 1500, so it's well earlier.
So was that manuscript ever published and we've lost all the copies, or did it just remain a manuscript?
No, it was only ever a manuscript, but I showed this to a friend of mine, a man named Bill Kalush, who runs something called the Conjuring Arts Research Center in New York. And he was quite interested in it and looked up the microfilm. And then he discovered that a Italian had transcribed it. One of the problems in reading the manuscript, though it's written in a clear hand, is they didn't always do things like make spacing between words clear. And I once had a long struggle trying to read a word which I thought was unambra, U-N-A-M-B-R-A, and eventually looked in the table of contents for the book and discovered it was una ambra, two words. And ambra is from amber, meaning a bead, so it was a bead, whereas before I couldn't make any sense out of it. Anyway, with a transcription now is available so that you can read it, but the lady who transcribed it was not obviously a recreational mathematician, and so she isn't always quite clear what's being talked about. And there's one place where she transcribed something as ISOG, I-S-O-G, whereas it's actually 1509. You can see the difficulty in reading even fairly clear manuscript.
So she's just assumed that some mathematical term she doesn't know.
So you might get something. And I've had experience with this before. We had, many years ago, in the Rubik Cube days, when I was dealing with something called Meffert's Pyramids, a book on it was written in German, and the people here were ready to publish it in English, but they mentioned that they weren't entirely clear about something. And I looked at it and discovered that the main move, which they were using to do all the restoration, they had left off one step. Totally incomprehensible. But another thing was that they used the translator. There are, in permutations, there are odd and even permutations. Now, in German, these are gerade and ungerade. And in English, gerade and ungerade basically translates as straight and crooked, is the simplest meaning. And that's what they had used for it. So you had straight permutations and crooked permutations, which didn't make any sense in English as well. Anyway, getting back to this thing, I showed this to my friend Bill Kalush, who collects conjuring books. And old conjuring books overlap with old mathematics books because lots of sort of early 19th century and earlier books are on amusements or recreations, and they'll have a section on conjuring and a section on mathematical puzzles and the section on games, etc. And he got very excited by it, and he knows people who are interested in the history of conjuring in Italy, and he showed it to them, and they got excited because this appears to be the first usage of cards in magic tricks. They were used as not to do sleight of hand, but for divination. You know, pick a card and then do something, and I will tell you what it is, kind of thing.
Are these not, playing cards, or were they?
These would have been tarot-type cards. Okay. But playing cards had only just come into Europe in about the 14th century. So it's, we have dating on the how the playing cards came into Europe, because various people like the Vatican or the rulers of various cities prohibited certain games because they felt people were enjoying themselves too much. So we know, and playing cards start being mentioned in places like Venice and Rome in, I'm trying to remember, late 14th century. So it's a, this is a manuscript of great interest to historians of magic, as well as historians of mathematics and historians of recreational mathematics. And my friend is a fairly prosperous gentleman, and he has set up this Conjuring Arts Research Center in New York, and he has a lady in his employ who does translations full-time for him, and she has translated this entire text into English, and we're hoping to publish it, maybe this year, maybe next year. The problem is that I think I said, or I mentioned to you earlier, that there's a manuscript, an additional manuscript by Luca Pacioli with additional material in it, which we haven't yet sort of amalgamated, which is in the Vatican, which I've only learned about. This has been published in an Italian form, and I've got it. But we've also got an Italian people who studied it and made a draft English translation, so maybe we'll combine the two together.
So is this book one of your favorites because it's the first of its kind? Or
basically, it's not only the first of its kind, but it's also extremely extensive. I mean, I have a chronology of recreational mathematics, and which I sort of list first occurrences of various things, and there are about 15 puzzles, problems that appear, as far as we know, for the first time in this manuscript.
So it's like the Shakespeare of maths magic.
Yeah, right. I mean, for example, the one-pile game, which is usually known as Bachet's one-pile game, which, from Bachet's book of 1624, appears here in 1500 or thereabouts. This is the game where, let us say, you want to make 100, or you start out with 100 matches, and you can take any number of matches from 1 to 7 from the pile, and the person who takes that last match wins or loses, usually wins. And there's a simple way of doing this, but more simply, it's usually something like 30 matches, and you can take 1, 2, or 3 from the pile. So it's the predecessor of NIM games, which have
some fascinating maths behind them, don't they?
Absolutely. Now, the mathematics behind the one-pile game is pretty trivial. But once you get to multi-pile games, it gets quite interesting. And something I got interested in some years ago, 30 years ago or something, was what about multiplayer games? Instead of just two people, suppose you have three people. Even in the one-pile game, this gets interesting because a player can, let us say, you have a pile of N, and you can take either 1 or 2. Well, you can choose who's going to win in certain situations. I mean, you'll be in a situation where you can't win, but you can, by your choice, determine who is going to win. And so you get into strategy and complications of how do you account for this and work out what the value of the game is going to be, etc. And so these pile games have a great deal of mathematical interest, and certainly once you get beyond two-player games, this solution is by no means clear. And, I mean, there's a good deal of research going on these things.
And just NIM itself isn't solved yet, is it?
Yeah, NIM is basically solved because, as you said, there's this nice binary technique for dealing with NIM.
Okay. Well, what am I thinking of? I can remember looking this up a while ago. There's a paper on using NIMBYs to do multiplication or something.
Yeah.
And I assumed that NIM was just completely solved, but...
Yes. But the thing is that Conway, when he extended the theory of games, has things called NIMBYs.
Yeah.
Most games have NIM numbers associated with them. But Conway then managed to show that you could add, subtract, multiply, and divide games and get a whole new range of number systems.
Yeah, and that's presented in a good book, isn't it? It's not the book of numbers. It's
No, it's his book called Winning Ways, which is most recently done as a four-volume paperback. It's an enormous amount of work.
That's great. Have you seen the manuscript of the Pacioli?
No, I must go. I've been to see other manuscripts in Italy. I've been to see the earliest Fibonacci manuscripts, which are from 1275
and
1315. Sorry?
Are they covered in rabbits?
No. Heavy leather. But I was amazed when I first went to see them that they're in the Biblioteca Comunale in Siena. And you walk in and you tell them what you want to see, and it appears. And I thought I'd be wound up in the basement carrel somewhere, locked away somewhere where it'd be dark and miserable. But anyway, no, they gave me a table right beside the librarian under a window, so there's lovely light. In fact, I got to the point where I had to move the manuscript out of the direct sunlight. I wasn't happy at least then. But they let me photograph. And the first time I went, I wasn't prepared for this, because very rarely do libraries let you photograph. So I went back again with a proper camera and close-up lenses and photographed lots of stuff from it. So I've got pictures of the first appearance of Fibonacci numbers, which is, I've recently sent copies off to people like Keith Devlin, who's just written a book on Fibonacci numbers. You know, this book has been there, available for, a century or more, and nobody's bothered to photograph it and use it in any publication, which amazes me.
Do you think they're just underappreciated there, then? Or?
Yeah, although there's a center for the study of medieval mathematics at Siena, which is very, very nice, and they've done a lot of work. But library is now, I gather, is charging to photograph it, and will want money if you want to reproduce it. But
did they see how enthusiastic you were when you arrived?
I didn't know for sure, but I didn't at the time sign anything, so I'm just, but I'm saying, telling people, be cautious about using these pictures.
Okay.
I think people are getting quite excited by it. Anyway, other things in this. There is a magic square in it, which turns out to be the same one that Dürer uses in his Melancholia engraving.
So would that have been like the example of a magic square that people are shown, and that's where that they've both seen it, do you think?
Well, yeah, I mean, he got it. We don't know where it came from, but the magic squares were quite popular in India and in the Arabic world, and certainly would have come across. I don't think Fibonacci has any, but Pacioli actually has the same square that Dürer uses. You may recall that in the bottom middle there's the numbers 15 and 14, which is the date in which he is doing the engraving, or done the picture.
That's a bit of genius. Do you think maybe he held on to the engraving for a while until it worked?
Right. There are other ones. This is the famous one of the blind abbess and her nuns. There's a nunnery, and it has 9 rooms, and the abbess lives in the middle, and the various nuns live around the edges in the 9 rooms. And since she can't see very well, she just goes around the edges and counts the number of nuns. And as long as there's the same number along each edge, she's happy. And they start out with 9 along each edge, but a little thought shows that you can rearrange the numbers quite a bit, and at various times 4 nuns disappear off into the bushes, and then 4 more nuns, and then guests come in. So it's a complicated thing, and this is the first, as far as I know, mention of it in Europe, although there are Arabic versions of it. There's also one where the lady counts the number of jewels on the cross. They go up the middle and out to each arm and to the top, and she gets an 11 each way. But she gives it to a friendly jeweler who proceeds to remove 2 of the jewels and rearranges it. So you still get 11 each way. And she doesn't realize she's been done. So there are, very classic things in here. There's also one which is sort of a magic trick. If you have 3 knives or 3 sticks, how do you make a sort of bridge that spans 3 wine glasses so you can balance a 4th wine glass on top? Again, this is, as far as we know, this is the first example. So there's a huge amount of stuff in here. Another one which appears is what I think is the first example of, or first discussion of, a geometrical optical illusion. If you take a strip of a certain length and another one, and you form a T with them, most people think the vertical is longer than the horizontal, even though they're the same. And in fact, you can then interchange the two, and they will still think the vertical is longer than the horizontal. I think I've got that right, unless it's the other way around. But in any case, it's a sort of a perceptual illusion. And as far as I know, he's the first person to ever mention such an illusion.
So how are the different bits of in the book presented? Is it a discourse where he says, "Now I've seen this and here it is"?
No, occasionally he says, "Yes, so and so showed me this," but most of them are just, "This is a problem, next problem, next problem." You know, and the problems are numbered. So he does a problem, and there's a lot of other stuff. Yeah, here we are. Yes, 26th effect. To find a number thought of by someone. And it's a simple divination. These things go back even further, back to Pseudo-Bede in about the 8th century, and which is a manuscript attributed to Bede, but includes several of these simple divinations.
So, because I'm a person who does maths jam, and I always seem to find recreational mathematics by talking to people and kind of sharing things in person,
right?
I don't tend to read many books with recreational math stuff in it. I don't have that many. And do you think that the kind of different ways to share things that you found, like, do you prefer talking to people in person, or do you prefer reading it in a book, or do they have their own strengths?
They both have strengths. I mean, the problem is that, you know, not many people know about this book, so, you know, you can't learn about it by talking to anybody except me. But it's clear, I think, from what he writes, because these puzzle problems, there's a section on arithmetical puzzles, which are much more simple, straightforward arithmetic, and then there are these puzzles which are sort of logical, and then topological, and then he got has a section on riddles, and because there's a whole section on rhyming couplets of very useful moral items, like proverbs. Lament of a lover for a maid. Very useful mercantile items and proverbs. On literary problems and enigmas, which are sort of riddles. Common problems to exercise the ingenuity and for relaxation. So he's got a lot of material in here, and some of it is clearly described as how he has learned this, or he has shown this to somebody, etc. So what he was doing, he was quite a peripatetic scholar, and he taught in, I've got a list here somewhere, about 12 different Italian cities, which is extraordinary even for his day, I mean, which is high Renaissance. He taught at various times in Sansepolcro, Venice, Perugia, Rome, Sarra, Naples, Milan, Florence, Pisa, and Bologna. and this is a lot. And he seems to have constantly gone out and talked to people, sort of magicians in the street, the sort of people you see outside railway stations doing three-card tricks and learning the techniques that they were doing. He doesn't describe juggling, but this conjuring is quite commonly done with, you know, people say, pick a card, any card, bet you they could tell you what it is, etc. And there are, I mean, these sort of people still exist in some places. There are still people who do street magic. David Blaine does those TV programs, and he's, you know, working on the street, a little bit set up, but still it corresponds to a way that some magicians make a living, actually. So it seems clear that Pacioli, although he was a third order Franciscan, it appears that he indulged in things that wouldn't normally be considered very religious.
He was a monk, was he?
The thing is, there's a portrait of him. He is the earliest mathematician for whom we have a real portrait. And the Franciscans have various levels, and the low third order is the one which you can enter with just saying, you know, I'm going to be a good boy or something like that. It's not a very rigorous monkhood, but this gives you the ability to stay in Franciscan monasteries in various places and teach in the schools, etc. He was probably the best mathematician of his age. He wrote a book called the Summa di Arithmetica Proportione, Arithmetica Geometria, Proportione and Proportionalita, which was the best and most extensive book since Fibonacci, 400 years earlier, roughly, 300 years earlier. And it was immensely influential because it was one of the first printed algebra books. And amongst other things, he says it doesn't think that the cubic and fourth order equations can be solved by the methods used for quadratics. He also describes double entry bookkeeping, which makes him the patron saint of accountancy as well. And it's an enormous book. I've got a facsimile up here, and it almost takes two hands to lift, and it was immensely influential. And he also wrote a book on De Divina Proportione, which is about regular polyhedra. And this was illustrated by Leonardo da Vinci. And the manuscript, the original manuscript, two copies exist. And recently, a facsimile has been done. It was printed in 1504 or something like that. But the facsimile is in color and has these wonderfully colored diagrams of things like the truncated icosahedron hanging on a string from the top of the page.
And I think I might have seen that.
You very likely have, because it's a very common thing. And the colored illustrations are absolutely beautiful and There is a facsimile which was done about 1990.
I think I've saved my collection. Someone has put the pictures online, so I'll put a link into the post if I find that.
Yeah.
That's all we have time for in this podcast, but in number 6, there'll be the conclusion of that interview and our discussion on books.
Now it's time to close the brackets, and that's All Squared.